October the 30th, 2008.
And I'll call order the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for the same date and time of meeting.
We have an informational meeting on the agenda with several topics, the first of which is reports on the adequacy of court facilities in Oregon pursuant to House Bill 2331. We have several witnesses signed up here, and Senator Walker, I see you as the first name here on the list. Does that mean that you'll be going first, or will we call some of the other folks here forward?
Well, I'd like to come up with all of them, and it'd be kind of fun to trump the chief today.
Why don't we do this? All right. Why don't we bring the other three up to the dais, and Vicki, why don't you just testify them there? That way,
I think that sounds great.
Very good. So we've got Chief Justice Paul DeMunez, Jerry Gatos, and Mark Pengilly.
Want me to start? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Senator Vicki Walker from Eugene, co-chair of the Senate Interim Committee on Court Facilities. Actually, it's just the Interim Committee on Court Facilities. And, you know, as my judges know, the court reporter always trumps anybody in the courtroom. So I'm glad to go first.
I'll second.
We actually just had a hearing of our committee on October 27th, which was Monday, and the three of us right here, Senator Pozanski, Senator Whitson, and myself, all serve on that committee, as does Representative Barker. So you're going to get a redo of what we talked about. And I'm not going to give you the verbatim notes, though I do have them, if you'd like them. But the Chief Justice and the other folks who testified did a great job. Let me just tell you that this book here is available to anyone who wants to review it, and it is the report that we got back from the architects. This is the first time in 25 years, according to Commissioner Green's testimony, that the legislature has ever undertaken any kind of comprehensive study about Oregon's court facilities. And I will tell you, as a court reporter working in these facilities, though my time is spent mostly in the federal system, where we have a lot more money, the state system is a mess. And this report reviewed 48 different court facilities around the state and graded them on a scale of 1 to 5 under a different criteria that was established by the Oversight Committee. And the Oversight Committee included a number of organizations such as the Oregon State Bar and the counties, and the Oregon Judicial Department, DAS, Department of Administrative Services, Legislative Fiscal Office, and Legislative Administration. And the purpose was to give us an objective understanding of where these court facilities are in terms of their sufficiency to meet the needs of the people of the state of Oregon. What this report did not do was to rank them in terms of need. So that's really one of the things that we asked them to do, was just simply prepare a chart after the testimony of, because you can go through all 48, but it's pretty tedious. So we wanted a chart that shows which facilities are not possible to be renovated because the cost is too high, which facilities could be renovated, and also what percentage of the facilities were actually used by the courts versus other services. It's a point that Senator Whitsitt brought up, that some facilities, only 20% of the court was used by the court. So it's pretty critical for us to hone that down, and I think what you're going to hear today from those who are testifying is, and particularly the chief, he's done a marvelous job here moving us forward, is looking at new ways to bring our court facilities into the 21st century and partnering with as many governments as we can. I can tell you personally that the city of Eugene has long needed a city hall and a city council chambers, and why they don't partner with the state on building a new courthouse and mixing that all together, I'm not sure, but we're hoping to prod them in that direction. What our committee ended up doing was asking DAS to come up with a report in 30 days, sort of giving us a better overall picture of some of the things that we've requested. We also, at the same time, have asked the counties to head up little work groups in each county, and so they would be think tank work groups. We want them to report back hopefully by the end of January about their specific analysis of their report, what it is they think they can do, and sort of help move forward on a plan. The Chief Justice will help them on the funding issues. We've also asked DAS to come back with a report on possible areas of funding. The one thing we did decide that the Chief doesn't know about, and so I'll tell him today, but he might already have heard, we asked the Chief to come up with the minimum standards for security for these facilities, because that's not really the legislature's job, and that is one of the overarching concerns, is that we have uniformity and security. Now, in design, that may be something left up to the counties to tailor it to fit their needs, though here we have some pretty set standards about what is appropriate for a courthouse, but we have asked the Chief to come up with those security standards. And we are looking at all kinds of funds to try to move us forward. The Chief did talk about possibly putting together a commission, an oversight commission, to help us move along in this process. It's not going to take 2 years, colleagues. It's probably going to take 10 or 20 at the most. But we like that idea. I think we're going to continue to talk about that in our committee, and I'll let Chief DeMunis talk further about that. I think that's all I wanted to say, other than let me tell you, I will leave you with this thought that Co-Chair Nathanson raised. The bottom line figure here is that it's going to take $843 million. But that's not really the bottom line figure. So don't walk away thinking it's going to cost that much. This is the figure that's based on these facilities in toto, not the amount that belongs to the state or that the state uses. So it really could come in at a much less amount. But what this report also reminds us is that as time passes, these costs continue to rise. So the longer we sit on our thumbs and not address the needs of the court, the more it's going to cost us in the end. And while fixing your court may not be a sexy idea in your community when you got potholes in the street, we really need to get on this, particularly as we're moving into the electronic court facilities. We're moving into electronic filing. The federal system has already been there for several years now. We've saved money. We've increased access and transparency to the public, and I think that is the goal that the Chief shares, as well as the legislature. So there's a lot left to do, and I will leave it to these folks to tell you what their concerns are and how they might view that. We did accept this report. I will let you know that our committee did accept the report, and I think everyone here pretty much is in line with what it has to say. All right. With that, anyone have a question? Okay, back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Coach. Well, gentlemen, I'll let you present in whatever order you think most appropriate.
Good morning, Representative McPherson, Senator Prozanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul DeMunis, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. With me is Jerry Gatos, soon to be President of the Oregon State Bar, and Mark Pengelly from Multnomah County. I'll just give a brief overview, if that would be okay with everyone. I'll try not to use exactly the same words that I used on Monday with everyone. But let me compliment Senator Walker and say it's very clear that court reporters are the most accurate people in the courtroom. And I commend you for reporting on what occurred on Monday. It was a very accurate statement of what we did. Let me just give you, from my perspective, 4 points that I think are important here. First of all, as I said before Senator Walker's committee on Monday, I want to acknowledge and compliment the legislature's foresight in authorizing the study of every courthouse in Oregon. This problem of the deterioration of court facilities is not unique to Oregon. That problem has presented itself in numerous other states, numerous other jurisdictions. And in my research, one of the things I discovered is that the very difficult problem of getting started to deal with that problem has been political infighting. and the legislature's foresight to commission this study and to remove the politics about who gets what and who does what and who needs what is a wonderful thing to have done and demonstrates incredible foresight. We've probably saved 3 to 5 years of wrangling by having this objective report for all of us to use as a basis. And I urged Senator Walker's committee to accept the report and as a foundation for us. And I would like to stress with each of you that perhaps the watchword for us in the upcoming legislative session would be the word foundation. What I hope we can do together, all three branches of government, is to set in place the foundation to address this problem. As Senator Walker very aptly said, this is not something we're going to cure tomorrow, not something we're going to cure in the next session. It's a long-term problem, but what we can do for Oregonians in the next legislative session is to put in place the foundational pieces that will permit us and those who come after us to continue to address this problem in an objective manner. And so I want to thank you for putting that in place. Another point, very important, is that you see here at the table bar representatives and county representatives and legislative representatives and senators who are united and committed to addressing this problem. Courthouses in Oregon should stand for as a symbol that justice is available to everyone, everywhere. And when our courthouses are deteriorating and falling down, that symbol of justice for everyone is missing. And so it's very important to all of us that we work to restore that symbol of justice, and people feel that when they go into a courthouse that they're safe, that they're dealing with, put it this way, that they're modern, that they're utilizing the kinds of things that citizens have come to expect from businesses and from government. And right now that's not present in our courthouses, and we need to work toward that. So I'll close with these sort of 4 points. As Senator Walker mentioned, it's important for all of us to utilize the report that's been done. It's a great place to begin as one foundational piece. Second, we need, as Senator Walker mentioned, and I would echo, we need to stratify this report. We need to do this in the most objective way that we can. We need to place these 48 buildings, if you will, into a stratification. And I would suggest, and I leave that to your good offices, but I would suggest that we look at this in sort of 3 categories. Those courthouses that need some enhancements, those courthouses that can be renovated, and those situations, those courthouses that need to be replaced, and that we try to place those to the best of our ability in an objective way into those sort of stratifications. And then one of the things that our local judges can do, our presiding judges are very good at being conveners in the community. And Senator Walker alluded to this. I would recommend that our presiding judges and our county commissioners convene, bring in all the stakeholders in the justice system, and address this, their particular courthouse situation, whether it's an enhancement situation, a renovation situation, or a replacement situation. And there's a model for this now. In Union County, we've been without a courthouse in Union County for 12 years. They condemned the courthouse in Union County over 12 years ago, moved the judicial branch of government in that county into an abandoned Catholic hospital. And you'll see that Union County Courthouse is rated the worst in Oregon. I always wondered that was sort of an oxymoronic because it isn't a courthouse. But the position that they're placed in, the location, is the worst. But when the court was recently, we heard cases in LeGrand in May. I had the privilege of touring that pseudo-courthouse and expressed to the presiding judge there and to the staff and eventually to the county commissioners that this is simply not acceptable. This is not a symbol that justice is available to everyone, everywhere. And I went over and met with the commissioners, and I'll be happy to provide anybody who wants to see the newspaper reports of this. They have created a citizens task force. Their first meeting of the citizens task force on their courthouse will be November 14th. I'll be attending that meeting. And their charge is not should we build a courthouse, but how do we build a courthouse. And so we're starting. There's a model out there to do that. So I had said accept the report, create the stratifications, have the presiding judges and the local community leaders form a group to respond to what the report says and to create a plan for that county. I think, thirdly, we need to do some legal work to look at the sources of bonding authority, make sure that we help the local counties with clear authority on how to do what they can do to raise funds to do this. And finally, fourthly, set up some kind of permanent objective commission that would create minimum standards for our courthouses, prioritize which ones would go first, which ones would be used, to keep this as objective as we can. And then finally, look and explore a variety of funding sources. And I'll leave that to another day for us to talk about that. But we need to think long and hard about a variety of funding sources that we might be able to use and what kinds of ownership should we have. Senator Walker did a great job of describing some of the things that I think we need to think about. We need to think about public-private partnerships, ways to do that. We need to think about the multi-use of courthouses and combine local government and the state in a variety to get the biggest bang for our buck in doing that in these courthouses. And finally, I'd like to speak to security. Senator Walker mentioned that one of the things in this report that will, some of which will be public and some will be not, is the serious state of our lack of uniform security standards throughout the state. And those are, of course, you know, the courthouses are owned by the counties. The commissioners have a great deal to say about what kind of security is in those courthouses. I have retained the National Center for State Courts to do a statewide study for us and to recommend to us minimum security standards, realizing that one size does not fit all everywhere. We need to have a set of minimum security standards, and it may be that this may be a subject for legislative action at some point in terms of saying every courthouse in Oregon, no matter where you're located, must have these three or four or five security things in place so that we make sure that we have a safe courthouse for the people who work there and for the public who enters there every day. And those are exceedingly important. So I want to say thank you. I guess one last thing. Our e-court project that's going ahead full steam now also is a contextual piece that needs to be considered as we're looking at dealing with these courthouses. Think about, we don't need the space when our files are not on paper. When our files are contained, probably not a good word to use in cyberspace, but when our files are electronic data, we don't need the kind of enormous space. We don't need a monolithic courthouse like we've had. We don't have to have that paper. Furthermore, we can think about having different court functions in different buildings. When you're not tied to the paper file, when it's accessible through your desktop computer, those files, you don't have to worry. You could have family court in one location. We've always had, in many of our counties, we've had the juvenile facilities located apart from the main courthouse. Multnomah County is doing a wonderful job with spit and baling wire right now, putting everything on, turning it into electronic content for their juvenile court. And they're doing this as they're going along. It's, so we need to think about how important e-court is going to be to what kind of facilities we need. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues and again say thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to appear before you today.
Gentlemen. Chair McPherson and Vice Chair Pozanski, thank you. My name is Jerry Gatos. I'll be president of the State Bar in 2009. I'm a private practitioner in Eugene and truly appreciate the opportunity to be here to support the remarks of the Chief Justice and also encourage you to continue looking at this complex issue. I was able to serve on the ad hoc task force in 2006 that produced the plan that led to this study in 2007, and I appreciate the leadership of this body and especially some of the members here. And I have to say Lane County is well represented, and I appreciate that in that leadership. So thank you. It is a complex matter and one that is has been a historical conundrum that we're finally addressing. And we truly appreciate that as practicing lawyers in the state. The bar fully supports the Chief Justice's approach. The assessment report shows the broad scope and magnitude of the problems. We need to address the problems now in a phased solution. The next steps the Chief Justice has outlined, both in terms of facilities and or in terms of process and in terms of how to approach this difficult facilities problem. The process should involve feedback on the reports for each facility from the relevant presiding judges and county commissioners, as well as consideration of those security matters that the Chief Justice just talked about. Chief Justice suggested, and the bar encourages, out-of-the-box thinking on this matter. We don't have to assume that the existing court functions must stay in existing facilities. We don't have to assume that they must stay in centralized facilities. We may want to consider regional court facilities. We may want to consider putting some court operations and court functions in different buildings. So it is a time for creativity, but that time for creativity has to always be led by that in the necessity of ensuring that justice for all and that symbol of justice for all, and that the rule of law itself is predominant in the minds of our communities. The bar also supports the creation of that ongoing legislative commission that would set priorities and conduct some type of process for allocating resources and updating the court facilities. And perhaps most importantly, the issue of funding will be one that I know we'll be talking about. These funding strategies must, however, be long-term and capable of maintaining viable facilities indefinitely. Bonds must be based on dedicated revenue streams, and the legislature should provide clear authority for the state to back those local bonds. And most importantly, we must consider the opportunities that we'll have for public-private both partnership and involvement in this process from the citizens of this state. The Oregon State Bar is keenly interested in the work of this committee and the legislature on this topic, and the Oregon State Bar and the practicing lawyers will certainly be here to assist in ways you require. So I thank you for your time, and like I say, we truly support and appreciate the partnership that this particular bar has with the judiciary of this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gatos. Mr. Pringale?
Thank you, Chair McPherson, Chair Prozanski, and members of the committee. I think your agenda notes that I'm an attorney. I have been an attorney for 30 years, but I'm appearing here this morning as a staff assistant to Commissioner Lisa Nato in Multnomah County. Well, I'd like to give you Multnomah County's view of the report and talk a little bit about the need for local flexibility in a solution to this problem, and also give you the Association of the Oregon Counties' view of the need for a statewide solution.
We appreciate very much the report that Senator Walker and the Interim Committee on Court Facilities has produced. It shows the scope of the problem, but as Justice Dominguez has said, there's no one-size-fits-all solution. Union County has courthouse problems. Curry County has courthouse problems. Multnomah County has courthouse problems, but they're all very different in scope and in nature. And while we should appreciate the compliment on our creative uses of chewing gum and baling wire, we would like to do even better in Multnomah County, because one of our major concerns is that we have a mass casualty waiting to happen in the event of even a moderate seismic event. We have the worst security, according to the report, of any courthouse in the state. Every morning, prisoners on a chain are unloaded from a bus at street level while traffic hopefully is stopped and brought into the courthouse. Up to 5,000 people a day pass through our courthouse. We have witnesses, we have jurors who are subpoenaed to be there. We tremble to think what would happen in the event of an earthquake. And the courthouse is within two blocks of a fault. We have studied our courthouse previously. We have had 24 studies of our courthouse in the last 40 years documenting its deficiencies. Nothing has been done of substance in response to those reports, reason being there's never been money. Our courthouse is the economic engine, is one of the economic engines for downtown Portland. It's the busiest courthouse in the state. And the report lists the Multnomah County Courthouse as an anomaly, because the price tag put on our courthouse is $209 million. Our county has made a decision to replace that facility rather than to renovate it, because to renovate the courthouse would require moving everyone out for 3 years to some other facility, which would have to be modified to suit us, then move back in after 3 years to a courthouse which would not have any increased capacity, which we need. And that process is estimated to cost $150 million. We need to replace our courthouse. The county has secured a site in downtown Portland on the west end of the Hawthorne Bridge. We are pursuing entitlements to try to remove a height variation that exists for that site. We have received $9 million from the Portland Development Commission to relocate a bridge ramp in order to make that site buildable. But this project cost of over $200 million is beyond the county's revenues, beyond our ability to pay. We also have a statutory requirement to provide court facilities in the city of Gresham, and the East County Justice Facility was not included in the assessment report, which has been produced by the committee. The county has been pursuing a joint court facility there with the County Sheriff's Department and the city of Gresham, and believed that it had sufficient funds from the sale of property to fund most of that project. However, the costs for that project have more than doubled. The project is essentially on hold because we don't have the money to build that facility. So Multnomah County has proposed that the statutory preemption on the ability of counties to impose recording fees be lifted, so that we could use some of those revenues, retain them in the county for the purpose of constructing and maintaining court facilities. This is a local control issue. We realize that the counties have an obligation, but the counties need more tools to help solve their own problems. Even this would not get us all the way there. In our county alone, we need $18 million a year to pay the bonded indebtedness on this project. So in addition to this request to lift the preemption for document recording fees, there still needs to be a broader statewide solution. The counties have not been able to do it alone. Our approach is supported by the Association of Oregon Counties, by the Oregon State Bar, by the District Attorneys, by the Building Trades Council, by business associations. And the Association of Oregon Counties endorses this recording fee concept. The Association of Oregon Counties can convene a work group to develop criteria to prioritize these construction projects, as was done with the community colleges. We being Multnomah County and the Association of Oregon Counties, ask you to be willing to work on new funding sources developed dedicated to capital costs. We recognize the growing revenue problem that the state faces. We think that lifting state preemptions that block local revenue-raising possibilities could be a very useful tool to help solve this problem. And as the Chief Justice has mentioned, it's also important that we create a statewide revenue stream to cover a significant portion of these costs. Thanks very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. For the benefit of the people here in the committee, we don't have the report has been referred to, but in some general outlines. But one of the key issues, and I'm not sure whether it addresses or not, it'd be helpful for us to know, is whether it recommends a change in the funding of court facilities, which has historically been a local obligation, while the operation of the judicial department has been a state obligation. And I'm just wondering, how does the report address that? Do you have views about what the balance should be between responsibility for state and local?
Representative McPherson, Senator Prozanski, members of the committee, I'll take a stab at that. The charge for the assessment was not about funding. So the report doesn't weigh in on who should fund what and how that should go. That was not part of their charge. So you won't find that in that. I can't remember how many characters there are. It's a huge, enormous report.
80,000 data points.
You won't find that. And I would not presume to testify this morning about what any mix should be or how that should work. I would like to work with all of the stakeholders in trying to determine what to do and how to do it. There are some models that have been used in other states, and I'll give you one for an example, just for purposes of thinking about this. And I'm not saying that would work in Oregon. I'm not saying that's the best approach. But, for example, in the state of Kentucky, they had a very the same issue. The counties owned the courthouses. The state was a tenant. And the courthouses were deteriorating. Through a lot of study and work, they came up with standards for courthouses, and I'll cut through the procedural part of it. What they decided to do was, in general terms, was make sure that they could issue local revenue bonds to renovate, enhance, and replace these facilities in each of their counties. And the state, the judicial branch, became a lease-paying tenant in those buildings and provided the debt service through the lease-paying, through their obligation as a tenant to pay those lease payments became that was the debt service that they used for those local bonds. That's one approach. I'm not saying it has to be completely a state obligation. There could be incentives that we might be able to figure out that would be a combination of state and local to satisfy the debt service on local bonds, if that's the way chose to go. There could be lease to own kinds of buildings in public-private partnerships where that lease payment could be a combination from the state and the county. I wouldn't presume to tell this committee how that would work. It'll take some study, but I see that as part of this word foundation that we could address this legislative session is trying to get those foundational pieces in place.
Let me just clarify on the report. The report itself was looking at 48 facilities that are in the state Multnomah County had three, so that's why you have more than 36, for there's 36 counties that are operated in some fashion as part of the court system in the state of Oregon. And then the charge was basically look at what is the prioritization as to the state of need, ranking them as to in disrepair, 1 through 48, and then the cost it would take to bring them up to speed. And then as Senator Walker says, we heard testimony that the information came in through data points, and there's literally over 80,000 data points that were brought together to bring this information together. So the report was very limited. The financial part is going to be something that we tackle in another means, other ways, and probably down at Ways and Means.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and McPherson. Just a quick question. In the report, you talk about the communities getting together and the justices help facilitate that. Do you have a timeline in the report when all those communities will get together and then compile information from what they learned?
Well, if I might, Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Comp, I did discuss that a little bit in my comments based on the testimony on Monday. We've given DAS 30 days to come back with a compilation of this report so we get it into the three areas that the Chief was talking about, what's able to be renovated, what needs a new facility, and basically what needs something done now. For instance, in the Union County Courthouse that was built in 1937, several things that are rated one, which is does not even meet needs, is the heating and air conditioning, the building configuration, the plumbing, everything's a mess because it's so old. And then at the same time that we're waiting to hear back from DAS, we're going to put the counties and the presiding judges to work, and we've given them we're sending them a letter. The co-chair Nathanson and I will send them a letter on tomorrow or early next week, indicating that we'd like to hear back from them at least a preliminary outline by the end of January, so that we can present this to the judiciary committees. I would say I would like a full report from them no later than March 1st if we're going to move on any of these kinds of funding options or anything like that. In the meantime, I would suspect that our committee will be meeting again, the Committee on Court Facilities, and I think it's likely that we'll go forward at least on the commission proposal that the Chief has outlined for some entity to help be nonpartisan, so to speak, in terms of designating which facilities really need some money and some immediate attention.
Thank you.
I think that answered your question.
That answers the question, because I was wondering about the timeline to possibly report back to us so we can assess needs. But just a follow-up, Chairs. I was previously a school administrator, and there's never enough money to take care of our facilities and our buildings, and we need to be proactive and be stewards of our properties and what the conditions and the safety of our staff and our people that are in those buildings every day. So thank you.
Representative Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to underline what I found to be a critical piece of Mark's testimony. And in so many ways, the state is really literally falling apart.
Yeah.
And I would just make the comment that if we cannot find the will as a body to fund some of these critical infrastructure needs, I think we really need to look at strengthening local control by lifting some of the state preemptions.
Mr. Chair. Representative Krieger, and then Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think over the last two sessions, we've had many people look at recording fees as a source of revenue for a whole host of things that might not even be related to directly courts and the law. And I guess it's Mr. Pengilly. Do you have any idea the number of documents that are recorded in Multnomah County and the amount of fees that come into Multnomah County already? And how are those fees dispersed to who and used? I'd kind of like to know that on a county level. We need to have that type of information if we're going to be talking about raising fees.
Thank you, Chair Prozanski, Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger. I can't answer the question as to the total number of documents. I have looked at the number of trust deeds and mortgages that Multnomah County records annually, and they record about 75,000 a year. I should add that has probably dropped this year with the economic downturn. And the revenue figures are split roughly 50-50 with the state. The county collects the fees and then sends about 50% of that to the state. There's a complex distribution formula. One of the elements of Multnomah County's proposal is that if the counties are able to impose document recording fees independently, the counties would then like to retain the full increment of the new revenue for the use of court facilities rather than splitting it 50-50. As to your question about the dollar figure, I've got a couple figures in my mind and I can't remember quite frankly which is which. I believe that the county receives about $9 million a year, and that about $4.5 million of that goes to the state. But I'd feel more comfortable if I were able to check my research and respond to you accurately.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and Chair Prozanski. Thank you for all the work on this. Just a brief comment. At first, I know that in Multnomah County, there's a very active program that brings thousands of school children every year through the courthouse to learn about the judicial system. And as somebody who was involved in that program for many years, I really appreciate the concerns about the safety of that building. I had a question about a comment that was made about how some of the buildings are used partially for court facilities, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, is it primarily county offices, or are there other uses for those buildings that are not used entirely for court functions? Thank you.
I'll give Chair McPherson, Senator Prozanski, Senator Bonamici. In the most general terms, we were talking about you have oftentimes located in the courthouse, the jail, the district attorney's office. There could be components for child welfare, and they can run the gamut in there. So they're multi-use facilities. That's not the case in every county. In fact, one of the things that happened after the unification of our court system was that those county functions, like the commissioner's offices and other things, and we use Multnomah County, or Marion County, which I'm most familiar with, all left the courthouse for a brand new facility that was built in that county and left the courthouse to its own devices. So it's not the same in every place, but we need to look at how that can fit together when we're figuring out what we need next.
Okay. Representative Cameron, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and gentlemen, thank you for your testimony this morning. A question that I have, and Chief, you just referred to Marion County, and having recently did a tour here with the people who run the jail and the defense attorneys and the judges, and seeing what they're doing here, that's pretty entrepreneurial and unique. And I heard you talk about people being unloaded in chains outside a courthouse. Here in Marion County, they really have taken set aside portions of the jail to have those prisoners be in court through video conferencing. Has Multnomah County looked at any of those types of as we move forward with buildings? I understand that the buildings are important, but really the important thing is maintaining the integrity of our justice system. But we can be creative through the technology we have. Can you talk about what Multnomah County is doing there in those areas?
Thank you, Chair McPherson, Chair Prozanski, and Representative Cameron. Nationwide, the way people look at courthouses and court functions is changing. Newer courthouses tend to have a different mix of courtrooms and different procedures in order to be more efficient. For example, instead of having all courtrooms being the same size, you might have a large jury courtroom for a class action suit. You might have a smaller jury courtroom, and you might have several small courtrooms which are just for judge trials. Video arraignments are becoming more common, and Multnomah County is looking at all of those options. Our ability to implement several of the new procedures is limited, quite frankly, by our facilities. But yes, we are starting to use the facilities on weekends where possible, do video arraignments and that sort of thing.
May I, Chair McPherson, Senator Prusansky, Representative Cameron, just to follow up on Mr. Pengelly's, the judicial branch has been dedicated to the use of video technology for a number of years now. Every single courthouse in this state is linked in some fashion. It has video capability in some fashion with every other courthouse and with prisons and with jails throughout the state. So it's a high priority for us. I believe over the last 10 years, it has saved this state millions of dollars in transportation costs, mm-hmm. in personnel costs, and it's the most... It has a complete safety factor to it, if you will, public safety factor, right. when you don't have to engage in that transportation. And so that, for sure, is what needs to be continued and to be part of our movement into the 21st century. And we can even do more on that. I'm involved right now with some prosecutors, defense lawyers in Eastern Oregon, who want to enhance their video capability even from their own office so that they can talk to their clients,
right.
who may be in prison in Snake River or in some other place, and not have to make that 2.5-hour drive to go there for a 20-minute conference about something, and be able to actually do it face-to-face through video technology. So we're exploring all of that. And Marion County in particular has done a really good job of that, as have many other counties. It's very common for arraignments to occur exactly the fashion that you describe. The one thing that we always have to keep in mind is preserving the sanctity of people's access to the courts, both and particularly in person. And when people need trials, they need to be in the courtroom. They need to do that. I've been sitting as a trial judge each summer in our one judge courts in Eastern Oregon in particular. And this last summer I was set for a week in Lake County in Lakeview as a trial judge. And this is the configuration. This is the configuration. The jail door opens. The prisoners come out of this jail door. The courtroom is right here, and the judge comes out of this door to get into the courtroom. So a person like me, who doesn't spend a lot of time as a trial judge, isn't particularly attuned to what the passageways are. I open my door to rush out to the get on the bench, and what am I? I run right into the chain gang. Getting ready to come out to be arraigned or whatever. And these are the kinds of things that we have to be able to address, and Representative Cameron, as you're noting, by use of video technology and other things. But security is paramount in this. Thank you.
There are no further questions. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. One of the areas evaluated was the under 8.55 was the rates of the quality of the audiovisual recordings in the court proceedings, and it rates it on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being abysmal and 5 being very good. The average across the 48 facility was 3.2, which is less than satisfactory. The mean was 3.0, which is even less than that satisfactory. And the range was actually from 1 to 5. There were several facilities that were rated at 1 on these audiovisual recordings. The audiovisual recordings are used entirely as a source of transcripts to be provided for anything on appeal. So the appellate court only gets the materials in that transcript that are made from those audiovisual recordings. So the integrity of that appellate system is equal to the integrity and accuracy of those, for the most part, of those transcripts. I had the opportunity to review a transcript out of Klamath County, which incidentally was rated as 4.0. And that particular transcript had as many as 8,000 errors in it, or inaudible portions. There was actually one area of about 12 minutes where the transcript was missing entirely. The appellate court ordered a second transcript of that proceeding, and they had it professionally compared by a part of somebody in the administrative court administration service. They laid them side by side, and in one place, in several places, the same question was asked, but the answer was either yes or no. Actually, either yes or no to the same answer. There was also a written comparison that in one transcript was more accurate in this area, and one transcript was more accurate in that area. So at the risk of throwing a hanging curveball, Chief Dominguez, do you have a comment to make on that?
Thank you, Chair McPherson, Senator Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt. I think that you in particular know my position about this. I was not in a leadership role when all of this occurred, but for various funding reasons, our court system went from court reporters, which I personally believe are the most accurate reporters in the courtroom, to audio and visual recording systems. I'm not sure that the technology... one thing I am sure of, I'm sure that the technology does not approach the accuracy of a court reporter. That I'm sure of. I also think it would be important to look as part of an adjunct to our court facilities and e-court, to look at whether audio-visual recording is really the best and most inexpensive method to ensure an accurate record from the appellate court. And I'll just give you one example. As an appellate lawyer, before I went on the bench, I had a lot of experience with transcripts. And I can tell you, just from a cost perspective, an appellate lawyer can read 90 pages of a transcript in an hour and make notes on that in an hour. If you have to listen to a recording, that 90 pages translates perhaps to 3 hours of listening. So you're already not in the right economic arena. So I share Senator Whitsitt's view that we need to ensure absolute accuracy when people's lives and property is at stake in those proceedings. And it may be, as we move forward with our court facilities study and with our e-court, that we look at what is the best method to ensure accuracy and whether we really are saving the kind of money that I think we thought we needed to do in moving away from court reporters and to the kind of technology we're using today.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I think that concludes, and then some, the time that we'd allotted to this topic, but it is a very important subject. Thank you, Chief Justice Domínguez, Mr. Bengill, and Mr. Gatos, for your work on this. It's obvious we got a lot of effort to put out here over coming years to solve a long-term challenge for our state. The next item on our informational meeting is a report from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training on the use of deadly force pursuant to Senate Bill 111. Director Minnis, I assume that we should bring forward probably everybody here in this group, Commander Cameron Campbell, Captain Suzanne Isham, along with Director Minnis. And Mr. Shepard, are you going to join this group here at this point? Very good.
Good campaign brochure.
Director Minnis.
Good morning, yes. Chair McPherson and Chair Prozanski. My name is John Minnis. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I'd just like to say it is a privilege and unique for me to testify on this side of the dais. It's always I'm always amazed at how different it feels. So if I appear a little bit nervous, you've already got me at that level. As you know, Senate Bill 111 deals with a very serious subject of the use of deadly physical force by police officers. There's a portion, I believe Section 8 of the bill, that addressed the department developing some training relevant to this topic. So if I can, I'd like to just simply go through and read my report because there are a number of areas I don't want to miss. Then I want to turn it over to Commander Cameron Campbell, who is Academy Training Director, to talk a little bit about some of the emphasis going on within the Academy Training section itself, and then also to Captain Isham, who is the Regional Training Supervisor, and then Mr. Shepard. And I do want to also start by saying that when the bill passed, the department went to the Department of Justice and said, what is our role and what are we supposed to do, and who is this report supposed to be constituted by? Because in reading the bill, it's relatively general, but we think that we're attacking this particular topic from a number of different angles. So following the passage of Senate Bill 111, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training has taken the following actions to better prepare police officers at every level for the potential involvement of a deadly force encounter. September of 2007, the department conducted an 8-hour leadership training symposium with emphasis on the passage of Senate Bill 111. Training session was attended by 236 police administrators and other managers representing 75 different agencies located in 23 counties within Oregon, and also included the Oregon State Police as participants. In March of 2008, the department hosted a 40-hour homicide officer involved use of force investigations training program, which we brought from Miami-Dade County, Florida. This is a program recommended by the International Chiefs of Police, and one many agencies send detectives to in order to receive reliable homicide training. It is considered some of the best training on a national level. The class was attended by 94, originally scheduled for 100, but six persons who signed up did not show. 94 law enforcement officers and some 28 separate agencies located in 13 of Oregon's counties, also including the Oregon State Police detectives, some of them at least. The department has implemented a complex scenario-based training program into the 16-week basic police training matrix. Scenarios include branches that may or may not result in the use of deadly physical force. This scenario training is realistic and allows officers to make decisions under stress in an environment that is safe but similar to what can be expected on a patrol shift. The students are able to learn what force should be applied and to what degree. This training substantially improves the officer's decision-making ability in all situations, including those requiring the use of force and the use of deadly physical force. Since passage of the bill, every recruit officer attending the basic training classes is now required to attend a minimum of 6 hours of use of force decision-making training using the Multiple Interactive Learning Objective System, otherwise known as MILO. There are over 200 scenarios with multiple branches that can be altered based upon the individual officer's response to the given situation. Roughly 75 of these particular scenarios are used and appropriate for basic training. Training has previously been optional. Oregon Administrative Rule 259.080.070 was amended in response to Section 5, Subsection 3B of the bill that requires officers involved in a deadly force encounter to attend at least one of two sessions with a mental health professional within 6 months of the incident. Refusal of an officer to attend constitutes discretionary grounds for denial or revocation of certification, and that rulemaking process is complete and in effect. And I believe we actually have one case moving through the system where an officer did in fact refuse to attend and is currently facing revocation. Many of the issues raised during the testimony on Senate Bill 111 involved the ability of officers to make sound decisions on use of force. Few officers post basic training have access to training that challenges their decision making skills in the use of force or the use of deadly physical force. Since July of 2007, DPSSD has conducted 42 Milo training sessions attended by 575 officers, deputies, and troopers. DPSSD has also conducted 7 Milo instructor development courses, resulting in 91 additional Milo instructors to further provide access to this vital training throughout the state of Oregon. DPSSD conducts a basic detective course that has been delivered one time annually since 2005. Each offering has resulted in a full class or full classes and a substantial waiting list for future openings. DPSSD is also currently developing an advanced detectives course. A component piece of this is the investigation of officers' use of deadly physical force. The course should be ready for delivery in the spring or summer of 2009, dependent upon available resources. In addition, DPSSD has participated with Clackamas County in the production of a DVD, which I believe is being distributed to you, which is intended to be distributed to the general public, talking about how Clackamas County has incorporated that as a component part of the plan submitted to the Department of Justice in their use of force planning process. In addition, we brought with us a DVD, which I don't believe we have time to play. I can provide this for you. It is an actual officer-involved shooting, which I think to some degree dramatizes in reality. It's a very real situation, but it shows you how unbelievably complex and how quickly events can unfold and the emotions that are involved in an actual officer-involved shooting. And again, if you'd like, we can provide that for you. I just want to redeem the time and let the committee move forward. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Commander Campbell to talk about what he's done. He's got some points he'd like to emphasize.
Commander? Thank you. Chair McPherson, Chair Pozanski, and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here. There are a couple of things that I really wanted to touch on.
Can you just ID yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. My name is Cameron Campbell. I'm the Director of Training for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. There are a couple of things that I wanted to sort of emphasize with regard to the training. A lot of time is spent sort of talking about the training that DPSST does around the issue of the use of physical force or the use of deadly force or use of force in general. And at times it may seem like what we're training officers to do is use force, when in fact I really wanted to emphasize that a lot of the scenario training, particularly the complex scenario training that is done in the basic training today, has as much to do with training officers not to use force as it does with training officers to appropriately use force when necessary. And I think that's an important point to make, is that we're it's not all about the use of force. It's as much about not using force. And one of the things that we know that we've developed progressive, modern training techniques within the Basic Academy program. And the new facility has done a lot to get us there. But what's missing is the training for the officers, the thousands of officers who are already out on the street, who went through basic training many years ago, whose basic training was nothing like what is offered today, and yet they're out there, and we have the only mechanism we have to get updated information to them, or the modern training to them, is the regional training delivery system. That's for many of the agencies in Oregon, DPSST regional training is the only training that those officers will receive once they graduate from the academy. Their agencies do not have training budgets. If DPSST regional training does not provide training for them, they get none once they get out of basic training. So that's an important component piece for us. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that with regard to officers' use of force, it is a scientific fact that the more confident an officer is in his or her physical skill ability, the less likely that officer is to actually use force. So the incidents where officers are prone to use force more often are primarily around officers who are less comfortable with their skill level and feel the need to get the jump to because they're not confident that they would be able to handle the situation at a latter stage. They feel the need to get in early, and that's problematic. That is also the product of training. It is training that will keep those officers' skills up to the point where they are confident in their ability and will result in less use of force. Thank you very much.
With your permission, I'll turn it over to
please
Captain Isham.
Chair Brzezinski, my name is Susie Isham. I'm the Regional Advanced Training Supervisor for DPSST. It's a pleasure to be here today. I just wanted to be here for you folks to, in case you had any regional advanced training questions. Like Commander Campbell said, regional advanced training, we provide that extra training for the folks after they leave the academy. So what we like to tell the students is the basic police academy students are there for the first 16 weeks of their career. Regional training is there for the rest of their career. We do all the advanced training, leadership, instructor development courses, skill-based training. And when we're talking about Senate Bill 111, the skill-based trainings, as we know, is a relatively, if you don't utilize your skills, if you don't practice on your skills, which includes defensive tactics, firearms, all those that encompass into Senate Bill 111, then they're going to lose those skills. And so we are there to assist them to make sure that they have that ability to retrain and continue to train in those and maintain the certifications as well. So I'm here for all your questions. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Captain Ashton. Mr. Shepard.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. The Department of Justice has three fairly limited roles in the execution of Senate Bill 111. First, to review and approve plans developed by each of the county planning authorities required by the bill. Second, to establish a process for reimbursing certain expenses that those local jurisdictions incur in executing those plans. And in relation to executing the plans, one of the requirements is that jurisdictions submit reports on individual uses of deadly physical force that end up causing a death, and the Department of Justice is responsible for receiving those reports. And finally, we're responsible for disbursing grants from the monies appropriated by the Legislative Assembly for the purpose of accomplishing those reimbursements. I reported on the Department of Justice's activities in each of those three areas on the little one-page memo that you have before you, and then it's supplemented by a separate set of exhibits. And in view of your agenda, I'll just stand by for questions then about any aspect of the department's activities.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several kind of thoughts. One of the things I think we've all become aware of the mental health needs of people, and you deal with them out there. I have some background in that, as Representative Barker has. And they're driven by alcohol and drugs. And it would seem that a lot of these people are involved in multiple contacts with enforcement people, 20, 30, 40, and every time it becomes a little more routine for them and they can become more aggressive. And what are we doing? And we're talking about what the officer is supposed to do, but we can't change the people that you're dealing with. Can you address that issue about these multiple contacts with these people? And almost every one of these incidents of shooting, with a few exceptions, there has been a routine over years of multiple contacts, and we know these people got drug and alcohol problems, which they all have mental health problems. We're not dealing with it at all.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, or Representative Krieger, excuse me. I'm going to ask Commander Campbell to comment in general, but the general background, the folks have heard about the Memphis model, the CIT training, crisis intervention training. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training has something a little bit different in the sense of how it's applied to basic training. students, some agencies around the state, Portland Police Bureau in particular, chose to train all officers in the Memphis model of CIT. We took a little bit different approach with respect to whether or not we mandate that 40 hours of training, simply because in order to effectively involve ourselves in a crisis intervention team framework, you have to have a local community involved. And every local community is a little bit different. And so, you know, we took the tack, we'll train to a minimum level and generalized mental health training and things that are going to apply in general to all officers around the state, and would advocate that, you know, based on a local model, that, that the local jurisdictions engage in more advanced CIT training as it might apply to their local jurisdiction. The one thing that's very, very important with CIT training and mental health training is, if you go back to the developer of the Memphis model, one of the things he says in the early development was, in order to effectively have officers who deal with these types of crises, mental health patients, you have to have officers whose hearts are really part of this issue. In other words, they really have to care about individuals with mental health problems, as opposed to seeing them as just another person they're engaging on an eight-hour shift. Again, goes back to who do you recruit, who plays a role critically in using these skills on the street, and then whether or not the local community is involved in a complete development of a plan at a local level. Because obviously an individual, and I've had this experience in my 27 years with the police bureau, in Portland, you have a civil commitment, and I've committed many individuals. You spend a great deal of time at a local hospital waiting for a psychiatrist or someone to come in and make a determination as to whether this person is going to be committed or not, and then there may or may not be a bed for them. There may or may not be a place for them to go. So again, local community involvement is very important, and it's a growing problem, not only in Oregon, but nationally, as deinstitutionalization of mental health facilities have, you know, attempted to develop local community-based mental health treatment, and unfortunately, as a generalized statement, that has not been executed well, if I can say that. Commander Campbell, if you could just speak to the academy training, mental health treatment, and how we've done about that.
Okay.
Training, excuse me.
Sure. Chairs McPherson and Przanski and Representative Krieger, thank you. The point that you raised, sir, was right on point with the regard to the multiple contacts and the fact that the level of aggression may elevate after each contact because the individual is more comfortable. Part of the training that we do at basic training is simply to have the officers recognize that every contact that they have with an individual should be based on that contact, whatever their response is going to be, not based on previous contacts. While there is some value, perhaps in the history of the individual, you cannot predict one's behavior today based on how that person behaved a month ago or 2 months ago or 6 months ago. That sets up very dangerous conditions when you're basing your approach, you're basing the way you go about it based on how that person was 6 months ago, and in fact that may not be the case today. So that's really how we address it in basic training. The reason we looked at, I participated in the Mental Health Caucus here last session, and the reason our approach to basic training is the way it is because we recognize that the crisis intervention training in the Memphis model has extreme value. It is a very worthwhile program, the way it's presented. But its value lies in the fact that it's local partnerships. It's partnerships between the local law enforcement agencies, the mental health providers, the treatment practitioners, the mental health recipient community as well. Those partnerships are what make the models as successful as it is. And that can't be trained on a statewide level because the resources that are available in every community are so different. So we looked at it and said we can train at the academy on those component pieces of the Memphis model that apply statewide. And there are parts of it. There are pieces of it that no matter where you are in the state, these things do apply. And so that's what we teach to at the academy. The other reason we don't expand on that is because it would leave the sense of
at the local agency level that, well, my officers received all they need to receive at the academy, and therefore I don't need to do anything else within my own local community or within my own agency to develop those relationships. And we did not want to send a signal that was in fact happening at the academy, that an officer at the academy, when they went through, received all the training and mental health issues that they needed to receive, because that's in fact not the case and isn't intended to be the case. And so we really didn't want to head down that path of leading that false sense of security, if you will, for the local chief, that they got everything they needed at the basic academy, so I don't need to do anything else.
Mr. Chairman, kind of continuing this discussion a little bit, the mental health training, the officer's involvement with individuals who are having these kind of issues is also further trained in the scenario-based training model, because a number of the scenarios that are actually delivered within the scenario village area might include individuals with mental health problems and a multiplicity of issues that might be presented in a complex situation and being observed in terms of how they're responding to the various situations presented, and then debriefing afterwards with the officers. Did you have to do what you did? Why did you do what you did? Is there something that you saw you didn't see? These kind of discussions go on afterwards and are highly effective in terms of training. But I think Commander Campbell actually alluded to something that I'll disclose is a constant battle within the public safety community to some degree, and that is the assumption that once somebody's trained at a minimum level that they're competent. And I call it the assumption of competency. If you're wearing a uniform and you have a badge, then the public assumes you're competent. Please don't make that mistake. Because you're dealing with human beings. And it doesn't mean that they're not good people and they haven't had at least a modicum of training. But with the developing technologies, with the types of tools that are being deployed, with the complexity of our society, the levels and necessity of training for officers on the street increases exponentially and has increased exponentially. And I, looking at Representative Barker, he and I both served in the Portland Police Bureau when I started in 1976. We had a pack set with two radio channels, I believe, or at least in the county where I came from, it had two radio channels. There were no computers in the cars. There were no phones in the cars. That was pretty much what you had. You had a revolver. Maybe you carried mace, an old nightstick. Saps were outlawed. Those are outlawed. No, people don't know what a sap is. You don't want to know, but anyway, it's an old tool for control. But things have changed today. If you look at the average patrol car that's out there in the street today, these young people have got computers. They have internet access. They've got access to law enforcement data system, NCIC, the National Computer Information System. They have multiple cell phones and multiple tools, multiple less lethal weapons and lethal weapons. All of which require them to make decisions in terms of the deployment of those tools at any given time. So the complexity of public safety and law enforcement is increasing exponentially at a time where the number of individuals seeking these types of jobs, this employment, is diminishing on a national level. Fewer and fewer people are attracted to public safety or law enforcement careers, which is creating a huge problem. So think about in terms of who's coming in as a law enforcement officer, what level of education do they have, how well prepared are they to meet the challenges of this complex and evolving community. And just in the 34 years I've been involved in law enforcement, the complexity is unbelievable. It's almost hard to explain. I don't know if that answers your question, Representative.
Just one little comment.
Okay.
I agree with the training. I understand the tools, and we're doing the best we can. But unless we address the mental health people that are causing these repeated incidents, you're not going to slow down the number. The numbers are going to continue to grow. So we've got to put more effort into recognizing what we can do with these people.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Minnis, when we reconvene in the legislative session and when we go before Ways and Means in our budget hearings, would it be possible, or perhaps Mr. Shepard as well, you might want to comment on this, to track deadly use of force incidents before this training as well as after on a per capita basis so that we can know whether or not this is really hitting the goal of increasing public safety as well as another goal, which is to protect the mental health of the officers involved in the shootings.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Shields, I don't think it's realistic to expect meaningful, DOJ anyway, to give you any kind of meaningful data that would allow a measurable comparison of that kind, simply because the incidents are too few to amount to a statistically valid comparison. We haven't yet had any agency file a report with the Department of Justice reporting on an incident involving the use of deadly physical force by an officer that resulted in death since the July 1, 2008 effectuation under Senate Bill 111 of that requirement. And although I know that I suspect there will be reports of that nature that do come in, I think the set of reports will be too small to allow that kind of comparison.
But so because they are so small, at least we could look at the number. Even whether or not it would tell us much would be another issue.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Shields, that the bill does require the submission of those reports by the agencies that whose officers are involved in any such incidents that have occurred. So someone should be able to report to you from the Department of Justice as to the number of reports filed. There may be other data sets that will allow DPSST to help you with that answer, but as far as the Senate Bill 111 reports go, I don't think that you're going to get that kind of comparison.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just simply try to respond. There may be some data that, again, I can't speak for Chief Sizer, but I know that her policies recently implemented have, at least she's told me anecdotally, resulted in a lesser use of force among the officers when the police were in. How she's getting that information, I'm not sure. But so they may be collecting some data that would show how policy changes might affect the use of force. I am aware, although I can't cite the exact location of the study, the San Diego Police Department a number of years ago had a significant number of officer-involved shootings, and there was a policy change at the governmental level, and the policy change was they wanted the law enforcement officers to use lesser force earlier in a situation, take people into custody earlier or make a decision earlier so that it didn't evolve into a deadly force encounter. And interestingly, the number of officer-involved shootings went to zero, but the number of internal affairs complaints started becoming unbearable for the administration to deal with. In other words, people are saying this officer is using excessive force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No officer-involved shootings, lots of internal affairs complaints, hence they changed the policy. The opposite happened. Officer-involved shootings started again. I would just caution you to say in the use of force, in the use of deadly physical force, is a very complex discussion for that very reason, because it takes a modicum of maturity and understanding and training. I would often say to our people internally, you're going to get what you teach for. If you teach people to beat with nightsticks, they're going to beat you with a nightstick. That's what they're going to deploy. That's what happened in the Rodney King case with the Los Angeles Police Department. They were trained to use nightsticks. They use nightsticks. Our objective internally in our organization is to provide the best possible training with the modicum of tools available to us, and hopefully train people to make good decisions. Because, as we discussed yesterday, oftentimes a deadly force encounter may be legally defensible, and we passed out the training that's been done in terms of the legal update. It may be legally defensible, but it may be a very unwise or tactically poor decision by the officer. So we're not lawyers. We don't make those decisions about the legal defensibility of a particular action, but we are very concerned about tactical soundness of an officer's engagement in the community. So, sorry, I'm blathering on ad nauseum. Sorry.
Senator Walker, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Minnis, I'm looking at the memo you prepared for us, and I think Captain Isham mentioned it. You've had, since July 2007, 42 Milo training sessions attended by 575 officers, deputies, and troopers. After listening to all this, it occurred to me, don't we have any kind of professional continuing education required for police officers in the state, like we do for other professions, such as my own?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, for the law enforcement officers, we do. And I believe, and please don't hold me to this exactly, I believe it's about 36 hours. That's not right. It's 80 hours every 3 years.
80 hours every 3 years?
Every 3 years, with a certain component, portion of that being use of force, and use of firearms and this kind of thing.
Okay.
I don't have that right in front of me. I apologize.
All right.
But there is a required continuing education component. In fact, the agency just recently went through and received all of the updates and filings by agencies around the state on whether or not they've actually done their in-service training and met those requirements. We have, I think, all agencies, with the exception of a couple, who have complied. And I think we're actually at a point where we're going to be discussing with the board the issuance of civil penalties against a public agency for failure to comply.
Well, thank you, because I appreciate that. I mean, particularly among law enforcement, you should have continuing education because things change, and you need to check in with these folks and make sure they're still tracking correctly and not wanting to use Night 6. So I appreciate that. And the question I had specifically was in paragraph 4, where you said this training was previously optional when you were talking about the Milo training. And what did you mean by that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it was optional. In other words, it was made available to the students after the normal training day.
Okay.
Or at different times throughout the day that the staff would be able to free up time. And as you recall, the previous training was a 10-week training program.
Right.
And internally, we discussed all of the scenarios that were being used by and large within the training, with the confines of the 10-week program, actually resulted in an officer-involved shooting. There was no choice to not shoot. And, you know, frankly, we thought that's not very good because we do want officers to engage in scenarios where shooting somebody is not the right answer. Maybe, but it's not necessarily the right answer. And that's what the scenario training gives us and the longer training time it allows us to do.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
John, if you could just follow up, I want to ask you about the mandatory requirement for continuing education. If you have someone that has gone through the department and got their basic certification, and then for some reason they're no longer employed by law enforcement, I understand that continuing education is not required. But is there some requirement before they are actually brought on and put back on the street that they go through some type of update to bring them up to speed because they've been out of service for some period of time?
Generally, if an officer resigns their position, leaves law enforcement, and they have been out of law enforcement 2.5 years or less, they would simply come back into a law enforcement career with no continuing education. And it's really a bit of a glitch in the system, if you will, because that is the way the statutory construct and the rules are currently standing. If they come in between 2.5 years and 5 years, they're required to attend a 2-week career officer development course, which is in essence a legal update. If they're out of law enforcement more than 5 years and they come back in, they're required to attend the basic training program from the very beginning until the end.
Okay. The last question regarding the regional base training. Do we have specific venue sites for that to occur, or do these float based on trying to get out and, you know, provide these regional based trainings throughout the state but not at fixed locations?
Mr. Chairman, I'll characterize it as a bit of a goat rope from what I understand. It's catch as catch can, and I think the five regional areas for law enforcement around the state were either housed with the Oregon State Police or the Oregon National Guard, finding venues to do. Classroom training is probably a little bit easier. I'll ask Captain Isham to address the issue. But emergency vehicle operations training, again, a very important decision-making skill. There are no good venues around the state for that. The other defense tactics training, same thing. It's very difficult to find areas where you can do the confrontational simulation training with CONSIM rounds in realistic scenarios. So, Captain.
Chair Brzezinski, thank you. We basically try to get any type of venue that we can across the state. We work with, we partner with other agencies, partner with community colleges. We do our emergency vehicle operations on old airport strips, doing defensive tactics in college or elementary school gymnasiums. We tow trailers around that have mats in them and other various equipment pieces that we take to those areas and venues to kind of make our own regional facility training areas. We do what we can with what we got, and the guys that are going out and doing this that are under my stead are fabulous, and they work very hard to try to provide that type of training needed to not only maintain their certifications, the other officers out there that are attending this training, to give them updated training again, because skills, if you don't keep up with your skills, you're going to lose them. And so they do everything they can. But ultimately, no, there are no specific regional sites that we utilize. We use what we can and again, partner with whoever will partner with us.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Well, we've gone past our time, but it's a very important subject, so I wanted to give it a full opportunity to be aired. Thank you very much for your work on this, Director Minnis, and you're the Shepherd and the others. We excuse you and move on to the next item in our informational meeting, which is a report to the legislature on the law enforcement contacts data review. We have two witnesses listed here, the Honorable Edwin Peterson, retired Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and I assume it's Brian Renauer, a professor of PSU.
Good morning.
Oh, it's typed as brain.
Well, it may be an appropriate comment. I assume that your first name is Brian, or
that's correct. Yes.
Yes.
Well, I just noticed.
Yes, but that typographical error has been made before. Good morning. My name is Edwin Peterson. I'm the chair of the Law Enforcement's Contacts Policy and Data Review Committee, which is popularly referred to as LECC, L-E-C-C. And on my right is Dr. Brian Renauer, who is chair of the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Portland State University. Portland State University provides the staff support to our committee pursuant to funding that I'll describe in my remarks. Now, I have circulated written testimony. I'm not going to read it, but I am going to just briefly summarize it. And I'd like to begin by saying I believe that we have a success story to report to you this morning. This committee was created by the legislature in 2001, and the legislation stated that surveys of the trust and confidence placed by Oregonians in state and local law enforcement indicate that there are Oregonians who believe that some law enforcement officers have engaged in practices that inequitably and unlawfully discriminate against individuals solely on the basis of their race, color, or national origin. The popular phrase for that is profile traffic stops, or to put it a little more colorfully, being stopped while driving Hispanic, or stopped while driving black. The measure also stated that it is the goal of this state that all law enforcement agencies perform their missions without inappropriate use of race, color, or national origin. And the legislation made specific directions to us. One was for us to investigate, to obtain data regarding traffic stops, arrests, searches, things of that type. And the other thing was to work with law enforcement to educate law enforcement officers about proper law enforcement practices incident to making traffic stops. As I say, the measure instructed us to make demographic data studies, and we have made a number of studies since 2001, and we have reported them faithfully every other year to the legislature just in advance of the legislative session, and our latest report will be delivered to you either in late November or early December. I don't think that there can be much dispute that we have discharged our statutory responsibility to make studies. We have done a number of studies. Their findings have been very interesting. Now, to me, the more interesting and the more significant fact, though, relating to our committee is relates to our relations with law enforcement. It should not be a surprise to any of you that there was a lot of concern on the part of law enforcement as to just what this committee was going to do. And so we started out, I suppose you might say, with a certain amount of questioning from law enforcement people regarding these investigations that we were doing and the investigations that we were asking them to do. But gradually, I'm pleased to say, the relationship between the LEC and the law enforcement community has become one of active, strong cooperation. Just for example, the man who was sitting in this chair immediately before me, Commander Cameron Campbell, he was just a name to me early on. Because our goal was to get work with law enforcement to educate law enforcement personnel about traffic stops, and many times there's a subconscious bias that might affect their conduct. And if they can be aware of that subconscious bias and be aware of how that affects their conduct, then they can correct their conduct. Well, anyway, Commander Campbell's name was just a name to us, and I'm pleased to say now that we work regularly with Commander Campbell in preparing the instructional materials at DPSST on this subject. And I might also say that the man that was seated at Commander Campbell's right, John Minnis, is now a member of the committee. So I think we have achieved considerable success regarding both of the charges that the 2001 Legislative Assembly gave us. Now, up until 2007, the staff that was provided to the committee was ordered by the legislature to be the Criminal Justice Commission. And in 2007, the legislation was changed, House Bill 2102. That legislation did two things. One, they removed the sunset provision of the 2001 legislation. And two, the legislation substituted PSU for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission as the entity to provide administrative support staff for the committee. Now, starting in 2001, we did work closely with PSU, but in 2007, the relationship was formalized. Now, I'm sure that some of you know, of course, and others of you may wonder where we get our funding. Well, we got our funding from the legislature in the early years, and then starting in 2007, we obtained a grant from a federal agency, the name of which I don't remember. I'm sure Dr. Renauer does. And that provides the funding for our committee. I might say that the constituency of the committee includes a county sheriff, a police, one or more police chiefs, a number of academics, and the result has been as I said, a warm, cooperative. Oh, I should say the head of the ACLU is also on the committee. I'm just very, very pleased with the progress that we've made since 2001, and I hope that we will be able to continue that progress in the coming years. As I said, Dr. Renauer is here. Would you care to make some remarks, Dr. Renauer?
Thank you, Chair McPherson, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. My name is Brian Renauer. I provide the LECC's staffing, and I'm the chair of the Criminology, Criminal Justice Division at Portland State University. In regards to our funding, as Edwin brought up, we are currently being funded by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, National Congressional Appropriation. And I forgot to add in here that we really want to thank ODOT Traffic Safety Division, which was the only state entity that could apply for this federal funding. And they're sort of our financial officers for this grant and are enabling us to continue this good work. I just want to comment on some of our activities that we've done over the past couple of years. In my report on page 2, our activities help us inform sort of 4 main areas that we're exploring related to the issue of racial profiling and bias. In terms of technical assistance, we've done some really unique things in trying to make it easy for agencies that want to collect traffic stop data by creating standardized forms of the data points that they need to collect and doing some different forms, a short form and a long form where they could collect more complex and rich data to inform their agency. We've also created Microsoft Access databases, Microsoft Excel databases, and PowerPoint report formats, so they can just easily sort of download and extract data, plop it into these databases that have automatic analysis programs in there. We've created videos for them that kind of show them how to do this and try to make it easier for the agencies to lessen the amount of resource and staff time that they would have to put forward in analyzing and reporting on this data. We've worked through the Oregon Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Chiefs of Police to advertise the technical assistance that we can provide to the state. One of the new things that we're working on right now is working with communication centers that it would be a lot easier for agencies to collect this information if it's being collected through a CAD system where it can be very easily entered by officers or onboard computer systems. The Willamette Valley Communication Center has an interest in exploring these different options with either CAD, onboard computers, or e-citation, which is a new technique that's primarily used by traffic officers, or the old way of doing it is potentially through Scantron. But we want to kind of work with them, develop a model, and potentially spread to the other communication centers. In terms of research and analysis, we've received data from 6 Oregon police agencies, and we've generated 5 reports, or excuse me, 6 research reports exploring disparity in stops across race, ethnicity, searches, and explore search outcomes, particularly whether they're producing criminal evidence. I just want to mention 2 of our recent reports in this year's annual report use data from the Corvallis Police Department, and they collect the most extensive amount of data points related to the context of stops and searches that the national experts recommend agencies collect. But it's very difficult to collect that information and have officers record all these data points. But with their data, we can do some multivariate analyses, more complex analyses to explore these issues. And we want to thank them for collecting that data. The agencies that are collecting this data have been doing so for roughly 7 years. So we do have an extensive amount of data out there now. We've also done statewide random sample surveys of adult driving populations to explore trends and perceptions of bias and racial profiling in Oregon. And the good thing is our most recent survey in 2007 is showing that those perceptions are lessening across all race, ethnicity groups in the state. And with our 2009 survey, hopefully we're going to see that trend continuing. In terms of training, we have developed scenarios and classroom exercises for new recruits going into the DPSST Academy, and those were approved by the Academy and were initiated in 2007. We've also purchased a curriculum for the entire state that's developed by the Simon Wiesenthal Center for Museum for Tolerance called the Perspectives and Profiling Curriculum. It is a highly polished video interactive scenario driven training exercise, and we bought the rights to this for the state of Oregon, that we can train any Oregon officer till eternity using this training curriculum that they have developed. It's being taught by police officers only around the state of Oregon. We have 30-some officers that have been trained on how to use this and apply this. In 2008, we launched our first training of this across the state in 6 regional trainings, going to places that are a little more remote necessarily than the metro area. And we've had 2 in-service trainings using this curriculum with the Benton County Sheriff's Department at Oregon State University. To date, we've trained over 100 officers with our curriculum, and we're going to continue that through next year. Let me jump down to some of the important findings and conclusions. One is in regards to our training. It's received tremendously positive feedback from the officers that have gone through it. We've surveyed everybody that's gone through our training. They like the trainers. They like the curriculum. They think every agency should be receiving this type of training. And this is a great advancement, I think, given that years ago, even mentioning this issue among law enforcement groups received a lot of defensiveness. And I think we found some trainers and we found a curriculum that they're able to really get officers to talk about these issues, these concerns, and reflect upon their duties, reflect upon what is good policing, and they come out of it feeling good, and they recommend it to their other officers, and we think that's a great advancement. We're also seeing some improvement in public attitudes in regards to bias in policing. We have a small group of agencies that are collecting the data, and it requires a tremendous amount of effort to get these data systems up and running within a police department, to get it past the union, to get your officers trained on how to do it and entering this information 365 days a year. And I think the efforts, particularly of Hillsborough Police Department, Portland Police, Oregon State Police, and Corvallis Police Department are particularly noteworthy, and they've been doing this for 7 or so years, and that's pretty tremendous. We still have some areas, I think, in terms of needing to clarify for other agencies the expectations, the benefits of doing this, and that's something that the LECC is going to be working on continuously in the next couple of years. In terms of future activities, we want to just increase our training throughout the state, keep these regional trainings ongoing, the same locations, create some new regional trainings, entice some new agencies to do in-service training. We're going to do one more statewide survey to explore perceptions on this issue. We want to work with these communication centers to create data collection systems that make it easier for agencies to want to do this throughout the state. And that's kind of the nuts and bolts of what we've been doing.
I'd like to add one thing, and that is, although this opinion is by no means unanimous, there are some police chiefs who say that as a result of the work that we're doing and the training that the law enforcement officers are receiving, they are better police officers. I suppose that may have gone without saying, but I wanted to say it nonetheless. Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. This was actually my bill in 2001 when I was in the House and those rascally senators put it into a Senate bill. But what I appreciate about this is that it has done what we wanted it to do, and your testimony indicates that. You testified that law enforcement training efforts have been the most widely accepted and sought-after component of the LEC, and that's what we were looking for. Chief Ron Louie from Hillsborough worked very closely with me on this, as did the ACLU, in making sure that all Oregonians felt that our police officers were conducting their business in a way fairly to all Oregonians. But let me ask you this. Justice Peterson, I still want to call you that, but you indicate in this paragraph, you say, since 2001, the committee has made a number of studies all of which have been duly reported to the legislature in our annual reports, most of which have validated the assumption that led to the creation of LEC in 2001. Are you telling me that you have validated that there is racial profiling in Oregon? Is that what you mean by that sentence?
Well, co-chairs and Senator Walker, I'd say a guarded yes, but I'm going to yield to Dr. Renauer to give you a more specific answer to that question, which is a very important question.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I would say that on two levels, the things we can clearly say we have validated is that there is a perception gap that still exists across race and ethnicity about the frequency to which Oregon police officers unfairly stop persons. So our surveys continue to show that there's significant differences across race and ethnicity, particularly among the African American population. Our recent survey, though, shows that that is diminishing across all races and ethnicities. And some of our recent research report in this year's annual report also shows that when you control for other factors that could relate to the formation of that perceptions, like having a negative experience with a police officer or being pulled over by a police officer or having positive experiences by voluntarily calling the police, that some of that disparity between the races goes away, particularly for Hispanic respondents. But I'll leave it at that, that there's definitely still a perception gap within the state. Secondly, the data do illustrate that there are disparities across race and ethnicity to the frequency of which they're stopped and disparities to which they are searched. The critical question is that the data is not able to address and answer in any clear fashion of what explains those disparities and cannot provide proof that it's bias, that it's racial profiling. And this is a debate that's occurring on the national scene with this, that this is kind of a new, collecting data of this fashion is new. It started roughly 2000, 2001 nationally, and we're just starting to get a lot of research on it at the national level, peer-reviewed journal articles and things of that nature. And for the most part, there's a lot of limitations to this type of data. And there are recommendations that it should not be used as sort of what I would call a pass-fail test, that the data either shows your agency's good or your agency's bad. What it's best in terms of showing is that there's disparity, and if it exists or not, and that the data should be used as a tool to question what are the potential causes of this disparity, that there should be some problem-solving efforts among agency administrators in partnership with the community to explore the potential reasons for the disparity, to explore and think about their deployment strategies, to think about their tactics, to think about training. And that's the best utilization of this data.
That's a great answer. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Renauer, the training, all those things are very interesting as well, but part of our job here, too, is to set kind of the parameters of law enforcement. And a lot of times when you look at a law as it comes across your desk, you have a pretty good sense of who it's going to impact. One group perhaps over the other. An example is the exclusion zones in the city of Portland were shown to have a disparate impact on people of color and also shown to be not effective in the city of Portland. Therefore, I decided to rescind them. Was there any illumination on particular laws that, say, different violations that brought on stops that were inappropriate, more often pretext stops, pulling people over for not having a headlight, anything like that? Was there any in the data, anything that jumped out at you that should be changed, do you think?
Yeah, the data, we're not clear on illustrating that there's any particular policy change within a department that may have led to increases or decreases. in stops. In some of our analyses, we do find that there can be significant yearly fluctuations in terms of the number of stops, in terms of the searches. But the explanation potentially for what caused it to go up or down is uncertain. Part of it could be, you know, data problems and errors, and part of it is we just don't have enough information from the local agencies of what might be happening.
Let me follow up comment. I just wanted to bring to the attention of colleagues and perhaps yourself. You may have already known this, but in the state of Iowa, they passed legislation recently that created the notion of racial impact statements, so that when a law is going to go into effect, say to increase this sentence or increase that sentence, that in addition to a financial impact, there would be a racial impact, with the assumption that when they looked at the data in Iowa, they just said, we've got a huge disparity here, so we should at least know what groups are most likely to be affected before we pass this law.
Any further questions?
Senator Whitson. Thank you, Chair McPherson. You may have answered this question, but I didn't hear it. Are the disparities explainable, or are any of the disparities explainable by more criminal activity in a particular type of crime committed by a particular segment of the society?
That would be an important analysis to do. However, the data is limited in that we often, for example, don't have data collected at a geographic level. So one might argue that stops are likely to be elevated in certain geographic places that have a lot higher crime, or that searches are going to be more likely to be conducted in those areas that have a lot more crime. And unfortunately, the data, most agencies do not collect geographic information about where the stop occurs. So when we get the data, and the way the agencies collect the data is just collected for the entire city. So that's why, it's very difficult to understand what is potentially driving the disparities that we do find. And sometimes when we control for other factors, for example, our recent analysis with the Corvallis Police Department, we looked at search disparities. When you look at it, just comparing Hispanic and African American, the proportions which are searched compared to whites, there is a significant difference. But when you control for other factors like the time of the day, the location of the stop, they do have location. They do have geographic location, the beat in Corvallis. As I said, they collect the most data. Whether it was male, female, et cetera, those disparities kind of go away. They're not as pronounced and no longer significant. So in sort of the long answer to your question is we just don't have data to test that type of question, and that is certainly an important question that it would be nice to test.
Then the bias could be driven then by the actual criminal activity in that particular segment of society, which is, for instance, in Corvallis, DUI or minor in possession might be higher in the campus area than other places in the city. If it was,
that's correct. Yeah, that is a logical theoretical explanation. Among other potential explanations for it, it would be nice to test that, but we can't test it.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for your report. I wonder if you have looked at whether the law enforcement officers consist of a population of either Latino or African American law enforcement officers that reflect the community in which they serve, and whether or not that makes a difference. Thank you.
Yeah, again, with the data that, you know, even embedded within the bills are restrictions on that we cannot receive any information about the officers making the stops. There's was great concern on the part of the law enforcement community about identifying officers in specific stop. So we do not receive any data that provides information on the characteristics of the officers at all. So.
Thank you. Can I have a brief follow-up?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if there are efforts being made by law enforcement to recruit officers who are of color or Latino for their to be reflective of the communities in which they serve, even if it's outside of this particular data in the report?
Well, I can only speak to the Portland Police Bureau because I live in the city and I'm very familiar with things, but I do know that they have been making efforts to outreach and broaden their approach to finding officers of color or different ethnicities.
I can follow up on that. I can tell you that almost every department of any size are going out of the state and going to different fairs, employment fairs, and actually trying to recruit even officers off of other agencies to come here. It's very, very difficult.
Any further questions? Representative Harker.
I believe you said that some of this, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you said that this study is funded in part by money from National Highway Traffic Safety via ODOT. How far into that grant period are we? And is there are there plans in place to assess the data set midway through and perhaps revise the data set that is being collected?
The first part of your question, we do have funding through 2011. So we still have a number of good years ahead of us to do a lot of work around this. Beyond 2011, the committee still needs to kind of think about, and we haven't had a lot of discussions about the future of this, and ideally we're creating products in a base that the law enforcement community and governance communities of Oregon can continue this effort on their own, perhaps locally, but we haven't had too many discussions what happens after that. In terms of the second part to your question, last year, after looking at all the data, we created, I mentioned before, a short form for what we would call the minimum recommended points that agencies should collect, and that's beyond what was in the initial legislative bill. The original legislative bill, some of the points that are asked to collect are good, but they're not as meaningful as they could be. So we have sort of these new minimum recommendations that agencies should collect, and then we have this, if you're really into this, the long form, which is a lot more data points where they can do much more, address a lot more interesting questions.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the data you're collecting is fascinating, and I was wondering if is it in a published, easily consumed format that the public can use, and certainly the policymakers might be able to use it when we take into consideration passing future laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd recommend on the report I've listed our website, so we do have most all of our data reports on there, and our annual reports, which have data reports and summaries tucked within them.
And would you mind saying that website, because in
sure.
case people watching on television or
it is http://cjpri.ccj.pdx.edu/LECC.
But how can they Google it?
Yeah, I think if you put in LECC, it should take you there.
And you will get a copy of our December report, Representative Shields.
And I believe it does take you there.
Okay. Good.
Senator Blitzett.
Thank you. Just one other question. Are you generally able to establish levels of statistical confidence in your assumptions?
In terms of, we do statistical testing in a number of our research reports, and we have collected enough data from some of the agencies, because now some of these agencies have been collecting it over 7 years. So early on, when we only had a year or two of their data, it was very difficult to make statistical types of statements. But now that we have, for many of these agencies, data across 7 years, and these agencies are generally larger agencies, you know, we can make more confident statistical statements. However, it's only in Corvallis. Ideally, the national experts would say you need to do multivariate analyses. That is, test in your statistical modeling other factors that could equally explain that disparity. Because most agencies don't collect much information outside the basic about 5 points of data, so we don't know a lot about the context of the stop. We don't know a lot about the officer-citizen interactions that occur during the stop. And it's only in Corvallis that we've been able to analyze these other factors that may explain the disparity. And we found, at least in Corvallis, when we do that, some of that disparity goes away. It's no longer statistically significant. Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, then, Justice Peterson, Professor Renauer, thank you very much for presenting.
Thank you, this Mr. Topic. Chairman.
The next segment of our informational meeting, which is a report from the work group on asset forfeitures.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next two reports will be short. As you know, during the interim, we have many work groups to do work on legislation for next session. One of them is the asset forfeiture work group. As you know, just recently we enacted Measure 18, which amended our forfeiture laws. By amending the Constitution, because going back to 2000, the voters of Oregon approved Measure 3, which basically required a criminal conviction for forfeitures. That was challenged before the courts, and the Court of Appeals found the measure unconstitutional. And between then, the legislature enacted a statute that would have basically done the same thing with some modifications, and Senator Brzezinski and Representative Andy Olson were actively involved in that. Subsequent to that enactment, and I believe it was 2005, the Supreme Court found Measure 3 constitutional, which then put that statute on a bit of a hold because it had constitutional problems because Measure 3 was found constitutional. To rectify some of the concerns, some of the oversights in the amended measure to the Constitution, we enacted Measure 18. For example, Measure 18, one of the problems that came up afterwards was, what do you do with animals? When you require a criminal conviction, you have the situation in Washington County where some person had multiple animals, including rabbits. You required a criminal conviction. They had to wait. The county had to hold the animals for a period of time. The rabbits multiplied. And so there were adjustments made there. Measure 18, as you know, just passed. In its enactment, we now need some updating to the forfeiture laws. For example, one thing we need to do is we need to reenact the measure that we passed in 2005 to clarify any relatively complex constitutional questions. And basically, there's a line of reasoning that if a statute is unconstitutional and then the Constitution is amended so it then becomes constitutional, the safer way to approach that is to reenact that statute, because many states in that situation have found that if the statute's unconstitutional, it does not revive by an amendment to the Constitution. There's a split in jurisdictions, but one of the things we will do is reenact everything that Senator Brzezinski and Representative Olson worked in 2005. And we're fortunate to have Dave Hendricks working on the draft. Dave has worked in this area since 1989, and he's spending a considerable amount of time updating the statute and updating particularly the forms. He will have a draft ready probably Friday. We have a work group that's met once in this. It consists of members of the ACLU, the District Attorneys Association, the criminal defense lawyers, the Department of Justice. We will meet again go over the draft to see if it carries out what we think it hopefully does. And this bill will then be introduced at our December 11th meeting for introduction into session. So what we're hoping that when you see this bill before you, on particularly during session, that you will see it pretty much a completed product of what is a very complicated area. That's the report.
Did I understand you to say that it'll be substantively getting back to the bill that was passed in the 05 session?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Well, what we will do is, included in this bill will be the 2005 bill, so it is enacted again to clarify any possible constitutional issues. I mean, obviously, we have Measure 18. It allows, for example, one of the things that allows for greater participation in the sharing of money to law enforcement. One of the problems you face was that federal law requires that if you conduct a forfeiture under federal law and local government participates, local law enforcement, that money has to go to law enforcement. State law requires that money be shared in different ways. And one of the provisions that we allowed in Measure 18 was that money could, in a federal forfeiture, if the local police, state police, or city police, or county sheriff's office participated, in many cases they do bulk of the work, they could be reimbursed for their efforts in that without running afoul of state law, state constitutional law. So that was one other issue that was addressed. So yes, this will reenact the 2005 law. We will probably, when we come to session, this is probably a bill that we probably want to move very quickly through the process. Because obviously, if you're a lawyer representing a police department, what do you tell the police when they come to you about, we want to conduct a forfeiture now, and we want to be able to get the proceeds, or we want to participate with the federal government? I represented the police department a long time ago, and I would have to tell them to hold off. Because they could run the risk of not only losing, but maybe having to pay the other side's attorney's fees, too.
And what's happening now before that implementing legislation is passed? Are there civil forfeitures being conducted in reliance on the vote of the people, or is it really kind of stalled out until this implementing legislation occurs?
Chair, members of the committee, I don't know.
I think most are holding back.
Yeah.
Just as a clarification, 2005, Rep. Olson and I worked together with the major interest groups, and we came to agreements. We said if certain things happened through the court system, other agreements would be honored, and that's what we're doing. So everything's going to try to get us back to where we thought we were going to be, because then a lot of people thought that Measure 3 may run amok on the Constitution issue, on the nexus of some of the connections that had to be for the purpose of the forfeiture. So my understanding from the briefing I've gotten, the work group has worked very well together, and everyone seems to be on the same page, and everyone should be coming in together in unison, making the changes. So it should be pretty clean and straightforward.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions from either committee about the asset forfeiture issue? Okay. Then our last item on the agenda is a report from the work group on victims' rights.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As you may remember, we referred to the voters, Measure 49 and 50, as it relates to victims' rights. They were enacted in May. As you may remember from special session, we had a bill before us, 3633, that the Attorney General had a work group, and they spent numerous hours working on for about 6 or 7 months. It's a very complicated piece of legislation. As you know, victims' rights are in the Constitution. And the bill went through House Judiciary Committee, and because it has a fiscal impact, it went to the Ways and Means Committee, and as you know, we had a short session, and it just didn't make it through the process, probably because of a time element. Subsequent to session, issues came up, particularly from the Multnomah District Attorney's Office. They run large volumes of cases. They probably do 35-40% of the criminal work in the state. And they raised issues as much on process and procedure that would have been very difficult for them to deal with. So the chair has asked me to put together a work group. Representative Barker has participated, so has Senator Bonamici. We have met probably about five or six times, and we have worked our way through 3633, line by line, comma by comma, and we are pretty much completed our first go-through in the draft. Josh Nasby from Legislative Counsel's office has been at every meeting. We have finished our last meeting last Tuesday. He's going to do a draft. I will then meet with the work group again for the purposes of really just making sure that there's no ambiguity in the language. We will not be addressing policy issues. The ground rules for the group have been basically this. Unless there's consensus, we stick with 3633. Unless we've already reached consensus and agreed, and then someone comes in later and says, boy, I didn't agree to that. Well, if you're not at the table, you lose. What I've also, one of the other ground rules is if you disagree with the policy, that's obviously a legislative choice, we will work with you during session to get an amendment so that issue can be clearly before the committee. At this stage, we do not have any requests for amendments. This bill will be before you on December 11th also for introduction into session. And our job has been made a lot easier by the work that the Department of Justice, and particularly Hardy Myers and Pete Shepard, had done before us. And I think we've addressed almost all the issues of the Multnomah District Attorney's Office, with the exception of one which goes sometimes beyond this issue, and that is the right for someone who's incarcerated by statute to have a trial within 60 days. And there's been a couple of work groups on that trying to work out the balance of right of the victim to participate, particularly if they get in the process late, at the same time for the defendant to have a speedy trial. And we are waiting on one group to get back to us to say if they can are amenable to the compromise.
I'd like to follow up on that. What is the compromise?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we did is we asked Judge Block to meet with the Criminal Defense Bar, Victims' Rights people, and the District Attorney's Office. And I don't have the language in front of me, but I believe it would basically start the clock running from the day the victim comes in, and maybe Senator Bonamici can help me a little bit in this one.
What I recall is that it wouldn't go beyond a 14 days past the 60.
Okay.
Is that your
that's
recollection?
Correct. That's my recollection.
Under no circumstances would the 60 days be extended beyond an additional 14 days.
Let's just keep in mind when that bill was passed, one of the agreements or one of the understandings, I should say, is that constitutional rights for defendants were not going to be impacted. If we start impacting that, we're going to have trouble with the courts. Mm-hmm. We're going to cause a problem that we're going to, in my opinion, re-victimize victims, because they may be going through multiple proceedings, because these individuals that have been charged and then convicted are going to be wanting to have new trials. And I'm going to be very concerned that if we're getting into a place where we could potentially cause victims to be re-victimized, to have to go through a trial more than once, and to have basically us needing to put money into systems to retry people that have been tried or found to be tried not in a speedy trial, or even worse, lose a case outright because they get something dismissed because they were not tried in an appropriate time.
I want to probe just one aspect of this, which is that the bill that we considered, 3633 is the number, in the session earlier this year, it was approved on a policy basis in the House Judiciary Committee, then went to Ways and Means, and then failed because of a fiscal impact. And that was a better time in terms of the revenue projections of the state as compared to where we're likely to be in the upcoming session. So my question is, to what extent is the work group looking at the drivers of cost that prevented 3633 from moving forward earlier this year in shaping what will come forward in this next session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative McPherson, my sense was that it died in Ways and Means. There was a cost to it, and that sent it to Ways and Means. I think it died because of the complexity of the bill and the shortness and the lateness of what it got there. That's at least my read. But you must remember, these are constitutional provisions. If we do not enact a statute that serves as a map through this process, then it will be developed by case law. In fact, the courts from the Uniform Trial Court rules have already set for some of this process and procedure, but there's only so far they can go. So as it relates to the expense of the bill, it's going to be there anyways. In fact, you could argue with legislation and a clearer roadmap, in the long run, it will be less expensive. But there are expenses involved in this regardless, because it requires more hearings, more time before the courts. It requires district attorneys to do things. It gives victims independent rights, which they did not have before the adoption of these amendments to the Constitution. So it's there.
Well, one of the issues that I recall from our work on this months ago is that the constitutional provisions have a pretty broad scope as to who's a victim, mm-hmm. and the bill that we were considering went to the full scope of all those people who are constitutionally defined as victims in creating these procedural rights. And one of the questions was whether that would be narrowed, whether the statutory procedural rights implementing these broad concepts would be more narrowly drawn around a subset of victims. And has that been addressed at all?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know, but I can tell you we've had debates on the issue of whether the victim rights amendments to the Constitution apply to parole hearings. And you can obviously address those issues through statute, and then there is another work group that the parole board has that they may address that issue through rule because of some recent issues they've had. I've looked at the Constitution, and I think you can make a great argument either way as to whether the constitutional provisions apply to parole hearings. You also got to remember, in parole hearings, they apply only to people that were sentenced before sentencing guidelines, 1989. So it's a diminishing population. So you get, as you well know, into nuances of language in the Constitution here. And in many cases, you really cannot clearly say when the proceedings apply and when they do not. Also, the issue of a victim, the definition, is open to interpretation. And then you have the problems which generated a lot of the concerns from Multnomah County, and this is very, very true in domestic relations issues when there's issues of abuse, is that, and anyone in the police officers in the room know this, former police officers, today's victim may be tomorrow's witness for the defendant. It's not unusual in these cases for the victim not to want to come forward for many reasons. And I believe that's what drove a lot of their concerns, is what do you happen in these process and procedures when the victim, you've got splitting victims. And one's testifying one way, one's testifying the other way.
There was concern that there'd be manipulation by the defendant in these cases to create victims to stall things, because a lot of times it's to their benefit to be able to stall a trial until the witnesses quit showing up and so on. And so those are the kind of things to define it clearly so that we can get to what we want, and that's speedy, fair trials.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions or discussion about victims' rights implementation? Well, if not, then that concludes that topic and all of our informational meeting. There being no other business,
thank you,
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the review of bills, do we know how many we're going to have? And is that, I mean, from the last session, I remember we had all the department and the bills, and so we're just going to be, it's going to be a machine running through the bills and.
Because our committee is the last one to meet before the regular next regular session convenes, then we will have a lot of bills that will be introduced as committee bills, and so it'll be quite a stack. So anticipate that in our December meeting.
Follow that, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. I know procedure we usually approve them, but could at least we get a title or something about it? We don't need all copies of the bills, but the bills and maybe what it's about in case we have a strong position on it or something we'd want to look into.
Normally what we get is a list of all of the bills, and realize that because we're the last committee, not only will we have bills that we would say are germane to the judiciary, there's going to be a lot of other stuff that's coming in. They're using us as that vehicle to get stuff into the system. But traditionally, we have multiple pages with certain identification information, not necessarily the actual bills themselves. But it will be, I'm guessing, a couple hundred?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you know, you yourself have sat through many of these meetings. It's traditional for the chair of the committee to make a statement, or the chairs to make a statement that the vote is not endorsing the bill. It's simply to facilitate the process. Let me give you an example. I think in the last 2 days we have picked up 20 drafts from the District Attorneys Association and from the Defense Bar. We was talking to them a lot earlier, but it took them a long time to get approval from their committees to get the bills here. I had someone from another committee speak to me yesterday, an administrator. The bill that they introduced, they want to make changes to, they're closed down. And we will. I said that I think we could probably accommodate them because, in my experience, it's easier to work on bills now. And it's easier to get a draft done now than it's very difficult to draft complex legislation during session. So I think you're right. I mean, experiences, any guidance will be between 100 and 200 bills and probably closer to 200.
Yeah. The other part is I think the co-chairs and those who will more than likely be in the positions of chairing next session will be meeting probably after our next meeting or someplace in that time frame, so we can kind of get a lay of the land and hopefully be a little bit more up to speed as to where we're going.
Thank you.
Okay. Cameron.
What are the remaining meetings? We have two meetings scheduled at this point, November 17th, which is a Monday, and then the final meeting, which will actually be the bill introduction and any other cleanup, will be December 11th.
Thank you. There are no further questions or discussion of any committee business. Then that concludes our agenda, and the House Interim Committee on Judiciary for Thursday, October 30th, 2008, is adjourned.
And the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary is also adjourned.